Wilcox, I expect back when he's ready. Mr. Gansner, Assistant Attorney General, with you, Mel Gansner, representing the state of Wisconsin.
Thank you. Chief Justice Abrahams, may it please the court and Counsel Hannon. My name is William Gansner. I'm the Assistant Attorney General representing the state of Wisconsin in this appeal in which this court granted the state's petition for review of a decision of District 2, the Court of Appeals, an opinion issued by District 2, dealing with the question of proof requirements for prior convictions for, in order to establish the defendant's repeater status, in order that the state might make use of, seek the imposition of, an enhanced sentence under the state enhanced sentence repeater enhancement statute. In this case, Mr. Saunders, after a jury trial, was convicted of several offenses for which he ultimately received two consecutive 30-year sentences that were enhanced. Each of those 30-year sentences were enhanced by a term of 10 years over the unenhanced statutory maximum of 20 years. So what is at stake in the case of Mr. Saunders is a matter of 20 years. A 60-year sentence as imposed by the court, or the 20-year sentence that Mr. Saunders believes alone should have been imposed. But beyond the facts of this particular case, what is at issue is a question of the proof requirements for establishing a prior conviction for repeater purposes in Wisconsin. This arose in every respect in a manner that the state, I will candidly inform this court, deemed a quite simple case. A man convicted in 1993 at a proceeding at which a copy, uncertified, of the prior judgment of conviction upon which the state relied was before the court, having been provided to the court much earlier in the case, and having been provided to the defendant, who thereby received notice as part of discovery. What was before the court was a prior conviction from Rock County. The uncertified conviction, prior conviction, judgment of conviction that was in the court file, that was before the court, acknowledged after the jury rendered its guilty verdicts in the case, as I say, was uncertified. But it contained the specifying detail that matched the allegations of repeater status that were in the complaint and in the information. Case number, offense, date of judgment of conviction, length of sentence, court in which the conviction and sentence were imposed. There was no objection at sentencing in this case to the court's reliance upon the uncertified judgment of conviction.
Are you going to argue waiver?
No. We don't argue waiver in this case, Your Honor, for the simple reason, as we conceded in our brief, that we read the Court of Appeals' prior decision in State versus Flowers, which remains unreversed law in Wisconsin, as we interpreted Flowers at the time, as I think as many people have interpreted it, as permitting this defendant to raise the issue. But I emphasize the absence of objection at the time of sentencing, not for purposes of waiver, but simply to indicate the simple evidentiary fact that there was no dispute at the time of sentencing in this case over the authenticity of the uncertified judgment of conviction, nor has there been in the intervening years any challenge to the authenticity.
What's the relevance of that if it's not waiver?
Because, Your Honor, the state's argument in this case is this. Where there is no dispute, where there is no challenge to the authenticity of a judgment of conviction. A court ought to be allowed to rely upon it. We think as a simple evidentiary fact and as a matter of common sense and as a matter of long-established practice in this state, that should simply be the rule.
So your rule is that if there's no dispute, the court can rely on anything?
No, certainly not. We don't come before this court to suggest that this court waive aside the interpretations that have been given to the repeater statute over the years as to what is adequate proof. What we specifically argue in this case, of course, is that when District 2 took its preference for a certified judgment of conviction and its reference to it as the best evidence of proof of a prior conviction, a use that it said it applauded District Attorney's Union, and then turned it into an exclusive requirement, that it went beyond what the law should reasonably require in those cases where there is no challenge to the authenticity of the judgment of conviction.
Okay, so if there's no dispute, the court can rely on, one, non-certified record of conviction.
Right.
Right?
Yes.
And that alone is enough?
We think that should be sufficient.
Okay.
Yes. In the absence of, as a simple matter of evidentiary law, it ought simply to be noted, the state didn't emphasize this in its brief, but evidence rule 910.03 makes clear that copies of documents are admissible and are deemed prima facie satisfactory as representations of the original, unless there is some dispute over the authenticity of the document.
Of course, the rules of evidence are inapplicable at sentencing. That's why you didn't raise it.
Strictly speaking, they are not. But the common sense of that evidence rule, we think, ought to be applied here, which basically says, if you don't object to the, if you don't believe that there's a problem with the authenticity of the uncertified judgment of conviction, a court ought to be allowed to rely upon.
Counsel, I haven't read the entire record, but I think I've read the relevant portions of the record. And the relevant that you're talking about, and the relevant portions of the record indicate after the jury was excused,
yes,
there was discussion between defense discussion. There were a couple exchanges between defense counsel and the court. I have transcript pages 154 and 155.
Yes.
And Mr. Ward said at 155, I believe that there is a conviction in Rock County and another one in Illinois, so that the repeater aspects of it is not in dispute. The court, it is not in dispute. Is that what you said, Mr. Ward? It's not in dispute. The court, accordingly, I find that the defendant is a repeat offender under the law. That's the exchange, one of the areas that you're relying on in the transcript. Is that correct?
That's part of the exchange.
Part of it. I know. I'll get to the rest. Is your understanding of the law, specifically State versus Farr and other cases, however, that it is only the defendant that can waive and not defense counsel when it comes to a conviction with regard to prior conviction and enhanced sentence?
Yes, we did not rely in this case, nor have we sought to suggest any change in the law with respect to what the statute says. You can establish a prior conviction for repeater purposes in one of two ways. Admission by the defendant, and we do not dispute the established case law and authority that says that admission must be a personal admission by the defendant, not by his attorney. And then number two, and that's what this case deals with, proof.
State proving it.
The state proving it. And under the label of the second means by which you can establish prior conviction for repeater purposes. There may be many forms of proof. Our contention here is that while a certified judgment of conviction, as District 2 has said, may constitute the best evidence, that there are other things that would constitute equally good and perhaps be entitled to the label best evidence, that an uncertified judgment of conviction should not, as a mechanical, formalistic, rigid requirement, be deemed unacceptable.
Counsel, we have in that portion of the transcript the court indicating, in fact, that it had in its file a copy of the March 22, 1991 Rock County judgment of conviction.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right.
I have read in its entirety the sentencing hearing. There is no such reference like that in the sentencing hearing.
To the Rock County, a specific reference to the Rock County.
That's right. So if you're relying on the sentencing hearing with regard to the judgment of conviction, that is, that there was no dispute that the judge had a judgment of conviction, although it was non-certified. I mean, this transcript is silent as to whether or not there was any acquiescence with regard to that.
You're referring to the sentencing transcript.
Sentencing transcript.
Without question. Proof of a prior conviction for repeater enhancement purposes is to be done prior to sentencing. It may be done at the sentencing hearing before sentence is announced and imposed, but it is to be done prior to the pronouncement of sentencing. In this case, that proof was done at the conclusion of the jury trial, when after the jury returned its verdicts, the court said, "What do we have here with respect to the allegation of a prior conviction?" And on that occasion, and this is the first part of the exchange that you read, Justice Bradley, from the transcript, the judge says, "The information alleges that the defendant is a repeat offender, having been convicted of a felony on March 22, 1991, at Rock County, Wisconsin, and there is a judgment of conviction as a matter of fact in the file. Is there any dispute that is the fact?" To which defense counsel then says, "No." And then says, "I believe that there is both a conviction in Rock County and another one in Illinois, so that the repeater aspects are not in dispute." But the first answer given by the defendant's counsel, is one that we think defense counsel was utterly entitled to give, which is there any dispute that the court has before it a judgment of conviction showing a conviction in Rock County from 1991.
So they only agreed that it was in the record. They didn't agree that it was true.
Nor did he challenge it.
What? Why?
Now, his language thereafter, and we don't rely upon his subsequent statement, there is both a conviction in Rock County and another one in Illinois, so that the repeater aspects of it are not in dispute. We don't rely upon that as constituting an admission of repeater status, because an attorney can't do that.
Well, but see, that's exactly what I started with. You're saying that there's no dispute that there is an uncertified judgment of conviction in the file for the court at the time the jury was excused at the end of the trial.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that is sufficient for the state to prove the prior conviction for purposes of sentencing.
Yes. Yes.
Whoa, I didn't know that's... Even though the defendant...
Yes.
Does not personally admit to that prior conviction.
Oh, no question. For this reason, I mean, the real issue here is, if the state is going to attempt to prove a prior conviction for repeater status, if the state is going to use that means of establishing repeater status rather than seeking an admission from the defendant. What proof can it use? If among the various categories, if among the various items of proof the state could use to establish repeater status by proof, the state chooses to use a judgment of conviction. The issue in this case is, must it be certified? And we're saying, no. This judgment of conviction did not fall from the sky. It was obtained by the prosecutor at some point from an appropriate source. I don't know exactly what it was. There's a fax notation at the bottom of the judgment of conviction in the record that refers to, that I can't state to the court for certain. It says Jackson DPP. I suspect that that means Jackson County, that regional office of the Division of Probation and Parole. But I don't know. I'm simply saying that this was not something that fell from the sky. It wasn't something that was came in over the transom. It was a document that the prosecutor, that the state obtained, presumably from a source that was qualified to maintain it, and there was no challenge ever made to anybody that this was authentic.
Was it an expunged record?
No, Your Honor,
there
was not.
There's
no crossover between our cases here.
So there's no question at this point in time that the defendant was convicted and he had a prior conviction. There's no question about that, right?
Well, we think that there isn't.
Why isn't there a question? Because he got an uncertified conviction or because the defendant didn't dispute it? Why is there no question?
Well, Your Honor, here's our point. We think we adequately proved the fact of prior conviction by use of a judgment of conviction. A judgment of conviction that was not certified. If the defendant wishes to contest the authenticity of that piece of paper, the defendant ought to do so in the same means that a defendant can object to the use of a copy in any court proceeding. I don't think this is good enough, in which case the state would go and obtain a certified, or have the clerk come and say, yes, I made this copy.
But that was the point that I was making, that no one has challenged that, and so there's an assumption, since it's up here and there's been several counsels, that there actually was a conviction that existed. So, I mean,
I've seen nothing, Your Honor, from the defendant in the Court of Appeals are in the arguments before this court that have by any means suggested that the uncertified copy of the judgment of conviction is not authentic, that there was no prior judgment of conviction, and that he is not a repeater. Their allegation is you didn't prove it because an uncertified judgment of conviction is not good enough, period.
Let's suppose that the defendant said not good enough.
Yes.
Not good enough. I put you to your proof. I put you to, you state the proof. I don't deny it. I just don't think that you've proved it.
Right. It's your burden.
What would the state have to do?
The state could do several things. The state could obtain a certified copy of the judgment of conviction from the clerk of the Rock County Circuit Court. It might be that the state would seek to obtain a certified copy from the State Department of Corrections of the copy of the judgment of conviction that it was provided. There might be a dispute over whether it has to come from the clerk or has to come.
Would the state say, that's ridiculous, here it is, uncertified, you're not denying it, we're good enough? Is that your position?
Well, we think that that ought to be the case, yes. But
then, because you started your argument with it is no dispute the state can rely on a non-certified record of conviction. Are you backing off that now?
No.
Because
no.
I've now disputed it.
No. In those cases where there is no question as to authenticity, absolutely.
Now I'm disputing it. Can the state stand pat?
No, then I'm sorry, Your Honor. If I've confused this, I don't mean to. Then I think the customary rules of evidence apply. Under Section 91003, if there is an objection to the authenticity of what is being, of the copy that's being provided to the court. A duplicate is deemed under the rules to constitute prima facie evidence of what it purports to be. If there's a dispute as to authenticity, then the court can find that the copy should not be relied upon.
What I think is at issue in this case,
yes,
which is on page 15 of your brief.
Thank you.
If the decision of the Court of Appeals in this case is allowed to stand, is likely to inspire numerous challenges to long-settled repeater enhanced sentences that may have been based upon uncertified judgments of prior convictions. The courts of this state are busily engaged with more than enough cases of current and genuine controversy.
Yes.
I think that's the issue in this case.
Thank you. We agree.
And the issue is not certified or uncertified copies because, as your brief states quite clearly, the state can easily get a certified copy. That's on page 16.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So I think we ought to get to good administration of justice here.
Good.
Right? I think that it's arguable that the good administration of justice says, state, let's cut the nonsense, let's cut the PSIs, let's cut everything else and admissions because people can't remember dates, they don't even remember what they're convicted of, and the lawyer doesn't necessarily remember or even have that. And what we ought to say is, state, you bring in the certified copy when you have a repeater, and let's just stop all of the cases. And then, in order to solve the state, I think the state ought to be arguing here. State can do that. And that is the best evidence. And we don't have to fool around with this nonsense. But, court, you ought to make this prospective.
Your Honor, we brought this case because we believed there was two things. One, there was a fundamental unfairness in the decision of the Court of Appeals as it applied here, applying in a retroactive fashion a preference for a certified judgment of conviction that was only announced years after this individual was sentenced and applying it as an absolute requirement. Number two, as pointed out, as you've correctly pointed out on page 15 of our brief, in our view, if this decision is allowed to stand, it will invite backward-looking attacks by defendants years after their convictions seeking to overturn the repeater status, the repeater enhanced part of their sentences. So, yes, what you have suggested with respect to retroactivity is if this court were to conclude in the administration of justice or in the exercise of its power, which the court, I believe, has, I would suggest that perhaps the court ought to withhold exercising that authority in this case, in just a minute, and I'll address that why. But if the court were to do that and announce such a rule, of course the state could comply with it. A part of me, as attorney for the state, wants simply to say, and we do say in my brief, tell us what the rules are and we'll comply with them. But don't make us anticipate what the rules are. Don't tell us to guess what the rules are and then at our peril find out years later, whoops, you didn't anticipate what a court of appeals would rule 6 years in the future. Yes, if there were to be such a rule, we think it should be prospective only to prevent precisely what I constantly anticipate would be the large number of defendants coming into court seeking to attack the imposition of past and past sentences.
The court has, or it can be argued, that the court in a number of cases that preceded Mr. Saunders said, look, this is the best way to do it, this is the best way to do it, this is the best way to do it, this is the preferable way to do it, bring in a certified copy of the conviction. But didn't require it.
Right. Well,
so,
yes,
no,
did not require it.
Did not require it.
Right. I don't think the court has repeatedly said this is the best. The court has recognized in a number of cases that this has been practice. There are also reported and unreported decisions of the Court of Appeals that recognize that it is not uncommon for uncertified copies to be presented.
Counsel, I wrote...
But yes, District 2 certainly has said this is the best evidence. And among the courts of appeals, District 2 has been, I think, most aggressive, not the right term, has been most concerned about that issue, about making more routine and more reliable the mode of proof of past convictions. Yes?
Why are you not relying more heavily on Chapter 910?
On the evidence rule?
Yeah.
Well, I think we are, Your Honor, in the sense that we have taken the position here. What 910.03 says, and I think I'm citing to the right rule with respect to originals and duplicates, makes clear that a copy is deemed to be prima facie evidence of what it is that's being presented, what is purported to be presented to the court. We presented an uncertified judgment of conviction and said it is what it is. And that's good enough in the absence of a challenge to authenticity under the evidence rules. Without citing that rule in our brief.
How can you pull that evidence and not pull, the requirement that it has to be authenticated? Where's the custodian of the record? I mean, what is this, a pick and choose evidence thing in an area where in sentencing there is no evidentiary rules do not apply? I don't understand.
No, Your Honor, as you've correctly noted, both now and in your prior question, the rules of evidence formally don't apply at sentencing. Purposely and sensibly. I'm relying simply, and the reason we don't cite the evidence rule in our brief is, in essence, because of that. The rules of evidence don't precisely apply.
If this judge had something in his file right here, and it's a great thing, and the state says, okay, I have a burden to prove something, Judge, mm-hmm. and it's in your file, mm-hmm. how is that admitted? Under the rules of evidence. How would you admit that under the rules of evidence?
Well, if we were in a proceeding in which the rules of evidence were applicable, were being applied with strictness?
I guess that's what I'm asking. Are we applying the rules of evidence or are we not applying the rules of evidence?
I'm applying the logic behind 910.03 to say that we are engaging in nothing but the most formalistic debate when a defendant questions years after the imposition of an enhanced sentence, when a defendant seeks to challenge an enhanced sentence years later by saying, you know, you couldn't rely upon an uncertified judgment of conviction, when that defendant at the time never questioned the authenticity of the document.
One of the things that was amazing to me in this case is the transcript on the sentencing.
Mm-hmm. The red light's on his side, not yours.
You can continue, but you'll have to give me permission to answer it. Okay.
And, of course, we have a law that says PSI, if it meets a pre-sentence investigation report, if it meets certain criteria, having the direct date and explanation of the prior conviction, is sufficient to be an official record. Under the statute. The first couple pages of this pre-sentence investigation report were incredible to me, and I said to myself, maybe we should reconsider that. It has, on the first page of text, the attorney pointing out an error in the prior conviction. It should be, March 17th. Not July 17th, the defense, the prosecution says, and they agree. And that's the date, not of conviction, but that's the date of the offense. And the state says, oh, yeah, we agree. Any other errors, the court asks. The defense counsel says, yeah, we have another error. The convictions that are set forth on March 26, 1986, that was supposedly, according to the pre-sentence, a conviction of burglary and criminal damage to property. But that's not accurate. It was only criminal damage to property, so the pre-sentence investigation report is incorrect. Burglary was dismissed. The state says, oh, yeah, that's wrong. I agree. the pre-sentence has a prong. Then the defense attorney starts to bring up another problem in the pre-sentence, and finally the judge says, hey, I'm not going to straighten up all of this stuff here. It's of no consequence to me. We've been through this before. These pre-sentences are for my use. If you feel it's incorrect, you send them a letter addressing their purposes. But I'm not going to take the time in this case for that purpose because it doesn't make any difference to me. Is this the kind of sufficient indicia of reliability that we're supposed to use as an official record indicating accuracy?
We didn't rely upon it.
No, but no. You get my point.
I do get your point, and I think it's a fair one. There may be other circumstances, certainly around the state, in which, and of course, defendants are routinely given the opportunity to object. But here's the point I would make. We didn't rely upon the pre-sentence report as the exclusive means of establishing, or even, frankly, the principal means of proving the prior conviction. And what was, given the problems with the pre-sentence report, the most reliable piece of evidence before the court? The judgment of conviction, to which the defendant made no objection, having cited many problems with the pre-sentence report.
But the judge said, listen, I'm not going to listen to any more objections. That's not of consequence to me. If you have any more problems, put it right.
Well, that might have contributed to the state's decision not to argue waiver here if it could be suggested that the court was squelching it. But the point is also unavoidable, and by contrast, Justice Bradley, I think, is very clear. For all of the problems that existed with the pre-sentence report, there were none with the single most reliable evidence of the prior conviction, the copy of the judgment of conviction from Rock County. It was not invented.
Counsel, I think Justice Sykes had a question.
I don't want to prolong this, but I do have a question. And that is whether or not this is an element of the enhanced offense that the state has been proving.
Well, the state, without question, it's not an element of the offense. I think this court has long distinguished between the repeater enhancement and the elements of the offense, but there's no question that the state bears the burden of proving everything necessary to support the enhanced sentence. And yes, the state had the burden of establishing it, and we think the state did.
And if that's the case, aren't we completely outside the rule about the rules of evidence not applying at a sentencing proceeding where you're hearing from witnesses and taking all kinds of other...
Well, there's some real conflict. There's some real tension there between the notion that the generalized notion that's been stated over and over again that the rules of evidence, strictly speaking, do not technically strictly apply at sentencing and a proof requirement.
Right. Obviously, the rules of evidence apply to proof of a prior conviction for purposes of penalty and
enhancement. I think that's fair enough.
And oftentimes, this factor, this enhancement factor, if that's what it is, as opposed to an element of the offense,
yes,
the enhanced offense is proved up well in advance of the sentencing hearing.
Yes, yes.
In fact, most often at the time the judgment of conviction is entered at the end of a jury trial or at the end of the plea proceeding.
Well, that's a good point as well. We're not at sentencing. In fact, the established case law says that it must be established prior to sentencing, which I think means prior to the imposition of sentencing. And as I pointed out earlier, that was the stage of the proceedings at which the state offered, proved the prior conviction in this case.
Right. And so to answer Justice Prosser's question, 91003 can and does apply here, as well as all the other rules about self-authenticating documents, etc.
I feel as though I've been subjected to searching and cross-examination here. You're absolutely correct. The logic, I think, is absolutely correct, Justice Sykes. We were.
Well,
and I should have been arguing 91003.
Was the uncertified copy introduced in evidence as an exhibit?
Was it? No.
No. So it's in the file.
Oh, excuse me. Was it specifically introduced as an exhibit? Not so many words, but of course the state noted that it was there, and the state had provided it early. It was already on file
with
the court.
Was it part of the pleading?
Excuse me?
Was it part of the pleading?
It was not attached to the information or complaint, but the contents of it, date of conviction, date of crime, court, were all, and sentence were all specifically alleged in the complaint and information. So it was not attached, but its contents, the specifying contents, were alleged, or specifically alleged in both charging documents. Yes. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Bethany Hannon, representing Patrick A. Saunders. Ms. Hannon is serving as counsel as part of the pro bono efforts of the appellate section of the State Bar. On behalf of the court, I do want to thank Ms. Hannon for representing Mr. Saunders. Counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. I'm Beth Ermatinger Hannon. I'm here on behalf of the respondent, Patrick A. Saunders, who asks that you affirm the Court of Appeals. Doing so will have three positive effects. One, for the state, it will erase any doubt that still exists as to the state's burden of proof when it elects to charge that a defendant is a repeater and seeks an enhanced penalty. The second positive effect will be for defendants. It will ensure that their due process right to be sentenced based on accurate information is protected. And the third benefit will be for the courts in the efficient administration of justice. As this court said in Farr, 9 years before Mr. Saunders was sentenced and repeated by numbers of courts of appeals since then, loose practice by prosecutors across the state creates multiplication of appeals for the courts.
Counsel, what was inaccurate about the judgment of conviction in this case? You said inaccurate information. What was inaccurate?
Justice Wilcox, Mr. Ganser is correct that Mr. Saunders nor his trial counsel made an objection as to accuracy of information contained in the uncertified copy of the judgment of conviction that was in the file somewhere. My point in addressing the effect of the rule that this court will give, and it's a rule that will apply to defendants beyond Mr. Saunders, is that accuracy of their sentencing will be protected. We don't know. No one at the clerk's office took time to ensure that a copy of the prior judgment of conviction here was accurate. The uncertified copy that's part of the record that's appended to the state's brief identifies Patrick Saunders, my client, Patrick A. Saunders. Said nothing about the content of that prior judgment. But going as far back to State v. Meyer, which I think was from this court in 1951, identity, making sure that the person who is currently before the court for sentencing is the same person referenced in the prior judgment of conviction, is one of the important features.
What was the date of birth of your defendant?
I believe it's in 1964. There's a date.
Well, you don't have a middle initial here, but you do have a date of birth.
That's correct, Your Honor. But as this court has addressed as recently as 2000 in State versus Prohoda, there are such things as clerical errors, errors that occur in judgment. And the simple act of certifying a copy of the prior record of conviction imposes no burden on the state. It's something that the state has done repeatedly, as reflected by a number of reported cases, that is the practice in many instances, and it would avoid cumulative appeals before this court.
would be the remedy then in this case? I mean, you think that because it was not certified, although it was allegedly the best evidence, what remedy are you asking for this one?
Because a certified copy was not offered at the time that Mr. Saunders was found to be a repeater, the state did not meet its burden on this essential element that it bears in establishing, when it elects to do so, a defendant as a repeater. And increasing, in this case by decades, the defendant's sentence. In State v. Theriau, a decision by the Court of Appeals, I believe in 1984, the Court of Appeals said the state has this burden beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, in our brief, we cite a number of other statutes, for instance, licensing statutes, that when a prior judgment of conviction is offered, it should be certified. There's no reason when we're looking at 973.12 sub 1, and it talks about one means of the state's proof if the defendant has not made an admission, is to offer official reports of different agencies, how an uncertified copy can rise to that same level of competent proof instead of offering a certified copy. One of the statutes that was cited in colloquy between the court and Mr. Gansner recently was 910.03, admissibility of duplicates. Mr. Saunders would submit that the statute that applies is 910.05, public records. The contents of an official record or a document authorized to be recorded or filed may be proved by copy certified as correct in accordance with 90902, or testified to be correct by a witness who has compared it with the original. So the simple act of the state taking the time to get a certified copy.
Well, you should read the last sentence to the court, too. If a copy which complies with the foregoing cannot be obtained by the exercise of reasonable diligence, well, other evidence may be given. The only negative implication there is you got to show you can't get it.
Certainly, Your Honor, and there's been no showing by that as to unavailability or inability to obtain a certified copy by the state. And it is the state's burden.
You're basically alleging a failure of proof here. We have the issue of the defendant's admission is completely off the table, right? Your whole argument is focused on the failure of proof. Is that correct?
Well, no, Your Honor. It can't be because of Mr. Gansner's argument that he led off with, suggesting there is no dispute here. And he refers to statements by Mr. Saunders' trial counsel. Effectively, I think Mr. Gansner is trying to equate an admission by counsel to an admission by the defendant. And the statute only allows for admission by the defendant. If the no dispute by trial counsel works, it's reversing the burden.
As I understand his argument, though, it's an argument based upon the allegation of a failure of proof here, that if the defendant's attorney agreed to this method of proof, then we've got no problem here. And that seems to be what occurred. It's not that there was a lack of a knowing and voluntary personal admission by the defendant. It's that the defendant, by his attorney, acknowledged that this method of proof was sufficient. Nobody's arguing that the statute technically requires a certain form of proof. I don't understand that to be your argument. The statute says what constitutes prima facie proof, but it doesn't say you have to do it one way or the other. So if we're going to find for Mr. Saunders, we have to find that his method of proof was inadequate as an evidentiary matter by reference to some other rules, the rules of evidence or otherwise. Is that not the proper analytical steps, the structure for this?
That's correct, Your Honor. Our position is there was no admission, and the statements made by Mr. Saunders' trial counsel cannot be taken as an admission of this essential element. Was there a prior judgment of conviction?
Well,
Counsel, that's a bit confusing, and let me tell you what has now come clear to me. And that is the focus of the state's argument, in fact, the state's argument, that there has been proof sufficient is set forth in a question by the court and an answer by defense attorney. And the question or issue is this question-answer exchange acquiescence in a mode of proof, or is it to be interpreted as an admission? Which talk about the same question, the same answer. Footnote 2 of the Court of Appeals opinion says what it understood the state's argument to be with regard to that question and answer. Footnote 2 of the Court of Appeals opinion says the state also argues that Saunders' counsel's acknowledgement of this conviction bolsters its position. We cannot agree. Any admission of a prior conviction may be inferred, may not be inferred, nor made by a defendant's attorney, but must be direct and specific admission by the defendant. The Court of Appeals looked at that question and that answer and said, oh, this is the admission. They're saying that the defense admitted it, and no, it has to be the attorney personally. Now the state is saying, or maybe it did before, but the Court of Appeals didn't understand the state case like that, that this question and answer are indicative of acquiescence in a mode of proof, not an admission. The Court of Appeals said this was an admission. So I guess we have to decide if this question, the court, the information alleges that the defendant is a repeat offender, having been convicted of felony on March 22, 1991 at Rock County, Wisconsin, and there's a judgment of conviction as a matter of fact in the file. Is there any dispute that this is the fact? Answer, no, I believe there is a conviction in Rock County and another one in Illinois, so that the repeater aspect of it is not in dispute. The question then is, does this go to the admission, as the Court of Appeals said it did, and you can't do it because it's the defense attorney, or does this go to the defense attorney acquiescing in a mode of proof? That's the way that it seems kind of interesting, but that's what it's boiling down to, but it seems to me that's what it's boiling down to.
I took it even from Mr. Gansner's lead off that there is no dispute, is that this was regarded as an admission, that a prior judgment of conviction existed. And I think the difficulty with this record points up what Farr and is a simple answer. Have a colloquy. The state can initiate that and suggest that the trial court have a colloquy with the defendant about any prior judgment of conviction that the state is relying on when it seeks repeater status, and it's got to be a prior judgment of conviction that the defendant had notice of.
But the court can't, if the defendant doesn't want to have that colloquy, the court can't require it, right? I mean, in this situation, the court couldn't have interrogated the defendant about whether or not he admits that this is his judgment of conviction. I mean, as the chief says, if the defense wants to, or if the defendant wants to stand there mute and put the state to its proof, we got to fall back on, you know, whether or not the state has adequately met its burden of proof. Not whether there's been a sufficient colloquy, or the defense attorney can do it.
I understand, Your Honor, that there's not going to be physical forcing of the defendant, but it's a simple means to add clarity to the record and for the state to meet a burden that it has. And it didn't occur in this case, and it could have. The state didn't ask for time to get a certified copy if it felt it needed that.
I'm just saying the state, of course, says it met its burden because of these, quote, colloquy or lack of it, and that's what happened in this case. And if the court, and that's why I asked you about the remedy, the remedy that you're requesting here, I don't argue with the fact that a certified copy would have been the best, but the issue is not necessarily is it the best or what is sufficient under the facts of this case, with the state having the burden to show that there was a conviction on that date, and that's what they had. They had the judgment in the file, and it was not disputed.
Right. Our position, Your Honor, is that the remedy should be based on a conclusion that the evidence was not sufficient to establish repeater status because it wasn't a certified judgment. And under 973.13, when a portion of a sentence is void, when a portion of it is illegal, that portion is void, and then that portion of the sentence is commuted. The Chief Justice had asked about the floodgates concern, and other than argument in Mr. Gansner's brief, there's not been a showing of a floodgates problem about obtaining certified copies since Flowers said this is the best evidence, or even since Farr. And
but not the only evidence. I guess, I mean, it's best and better, and that's the, I think the floodgate argument would only be if that should have been, and you didn't have a certified copy. That's the question.
Well, and Flowers.
It wouldn't happen until after this case, depending upon how it goes.
Flowers talked about a certified copy being best evidence, not vis-a-vis an uncertified copy. That wasn't before Flowers. What was before Flowers was an additional document offered by the state. I think it was a document that had been obtained from the DOC. And there was some challenge that Mr. Flowers himself had raised, and the court almost incredulously said, well, a certified copy of a prior judgment of conviction is the best, I think reading between lines, because it's the direct evidence of the prior judgment as opposed to a pre-sentence investigation or some other printout from another agency. And so that's where the best evidence comes from. And I don't think Flowers announced a new rule that somehow christened or elevated certified copies. Certified copies
before Flowers, before Mr. Saunders was sentenced in 1993, were the reliable means of accurately identifying a prior judgment of conviction for a defendant sought to be sentenced as a repeater.
Let me see if I can understand where this case has moved during oral argument. If the state must, as an evidentiary matter, prove the prior offense for the repeater charge, if that is an evidentiary issue, and as Mr. Gansner said, there's a tension between the rules of evidence for a matter of proof versus a sentencing proceeding, and that this is usually done before sentencing. So if it's evidentiary, 91005 tells you what you have to do for a public record. And that is certification, unless you can show that that's not reasonable, with reasonable diligence applicable, right? Which we don't have here. But if it comes under 91005 and evidentiary, then the state's position is that defense counsel can waive this evidence. And defense counsel can let the states bring in other evidence. But that has to be balanced against the rule that any admission has to be by the defendant. So we get a fine line in there. The defense counsel can waive the evidence, but can't admit it, because only the defendant can admit it. Okay. If the view is that it's not an evidentiary matter, state need not prove the prior conviction, then the rules of evidence are not necessarily applicable, and really anything that is good enough is good enough. We don't have to rely on the defense saying, defense counsel waiving the requirement of, quote, the best. Because if you don't have 91005, you don't have a best evidence rule. Is that what this has come down to?
I think that's where we've been going.
Pardon me?
I agree, Chief, that that's where this discussion has been going. I agree with the first part of your discussion, that the question is, if, as trial counsel did here, said there's no dispute to Rock County, is that on the same level as a defendant admission? And our position is certainly it is. To recognize it as otherwise is not consistent with the legislative scheme on an admittedly easy burden, but a burden nonetheless for the state in a situation where what could be viewed as draconian results occur decades for Mr. Saunders based on this. If it's not evidentiary, then what do we look at? An analogy, it's not completely in line with 973.12, is the OWI line of cases. And in Spades, a couple of years ago, this court said that certified copies of the prior judgment conviction or other competent proof can be used to show under the Chapter 345 scheme of prior motor vehicle driving convictions. In either Spaeth or Weidman, the court made some comparisons between repeater sentencing under 973 and repeater sentencing under motor vehicle laws, and said, we can understand why the burden is less here, because we acknowledge in those situations, 345, counsel can stipulate to prior judgments of conviction, but not so under 973. Why can they do it for driving? Because, this court said, the sheer volume of those types of offenses
the administrative nightmare imposed by trying to sort through the documents and the relatively lighter penalties. Those are significant distinctions when we're looking at the number of years of additional prison time at stake under this legislative scheme for repeater sentencing.
Now, the question I have for you, here's the dilemma. The dilemma for the state is that the Court of Appeals rule, if it's retroactive, can open up untold numbers. Now, I don't know what they are, and you don't either. The dilemma for you on the side of justice and fairness seems to me that, hey, we could settle this fight right now. We could just order up a certified copy. It's not the usual way appellate courts proceed, and I understand. We could order up a certified copy of this conviction and just make the comparison and say, hey, they're exactly the same, if they are. And to say that that your client should therefore drop, what is it, 20 years of a sentence because of a stamp on a piece of paper, stamp being certified by the clerk of court, I mean, that's pretty silly. So you're not really debating here the merits of whether or not this is an accurate copy or not. You're debating the technicality, which the legal force that would have required this as a certified copy. So that's the dilemma as I see it.
I'll try to address that, Your Honor. First, on the prospective enforcement, or will there be a number of other persons checking the records to see, was that an uncertified copy that got me these extra years? You're right, we don't know that. The state has not offered anything about that. In State ex rel Angela M.W., I think Justice Crooks, in your dissent there, you noted an amicus brief by Milwaukee County DA, which said, well, you know what, we haven't had any floodgates yet. I mean, that's the kind of thing that could have been shown to the court. It hasn't been. As far as could the state go back now and seek to obtain a certified copy of
this prior asking for?
Seemingly simple, but the Court of Appeals said in State v. Kepin that the state cannot belatedly introduce essential and substantive proof that is required at sentencing. And I think we've all acknowledged that the proof the state has to provide is due at some point prior to the sentencing awarded by the judge. That hasn't happened. Our position is it cannot happen now.
What about the concept that this be applied if there is a rule requiring certified copies, that it be applied in the future to your client and then in the future rather than retroactively?
That's certainly at the discretion of this court. One of the reasons for prospective application of a rule that either is new or is now being clarified, though not necessarily new, is judicial administration, reliability of reliance on past acts. And I think in Bell versus Milwaukee County, that's a pretty good discussion of the policy reasons underpinning when the court's rule should be retroactive in application and when it should be prospective.
Which case was that, counsel?
Bell versus Milwaukee County.
I think I understand the difference between admission and waiver, but I'm not quite sure I understand why waiver doesn't apply here.
It doesn't apply for a few reasons, Justice Prosser. First, because the state admitted this morning that it didn't argue it.
Make sure you speak up.
Pardon me.
I'll try that too.
So the state can waive waiver, as this court said in Washera County versus Graff. Recently, I think in 1999, in State v. Leibniz, that decision by Justice Bailich involved waiver, but specifically distinguished the type of events, as in Farr, when there was a guilty plea, when there was a not guilty and a verdict, and then a contest as to finding sufficient basis for the enhancement. So this is not a waiver case. The state didn't make it one. For all of the concerns that we've identified to serve the legislative intent of 973.12 sub 1, to protect due process rights of defendants, and to promote official judicial administration, Mr. Saunders asks that the judgment of the Court of Appeals be affirmed and the excess portion of his sentence be commuted. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hannon. Attorney Gansner.
I'll be as brief as I can. We have this defendant. We have the law. On this defendant first, briefly. The defendant asserts a constitutional right to be sentenced on the basis of accurate information. If he were before this court arguing that he had been sentenced on the basis of inaccurate information, the established case law would require him to prove two things. There was inaccurate information, and the court relied upon it. There is no such claim in this case. The defendant asserts a right to be sentenced on the basis of accurate information, but suggests that none was used to sentence him. Number two, with respect to the future of this defendant, the state has argued in its brief and resubmits here that since the requirement of an absolute requirement of where use of a prior judgment of conviction is used to prove a prior conviction for repeater status was announced as a requirement by the Court of Appeals in this case only, doing for the first time explicitly what the defendant concedes in his brief was only implicit at best in prior decisions, a new rule of law was in fact announced. It is the state's view that it is fundamentally unfair to apply that new rule of law, previously non-existent, to this defendant, to give him the benefit of it.
How do you get around the cases cited by your opposing counsel, that is Wideman and Spaeth, dealing with enhanced penalties for OWI and OAR? And in those cases, released on the same day, they said, as your opposing counsel noted, look, this is different. This enhanced the need to prove the prior conviction in enhanced penalty cases, OWI and OAR. It's the same issue. How do you prove it? And in those cases, they said, we're dealing with OWI and OAR, the defendant, attorney can stipulate, number two, the sheer volume, number three, the shorter sentences. So we're going to require proof less than the proof required in 973.12. We are going to allow uncertified copies of judgments of conviction. That will suffice in OWI and OAR. I think the negative implication is if we're going to do something that's less than required in 973.12, because of the volume and the short sentences, we're going to allow uncertified. Isn't the negative implication that under 973.12, both State v. Spaeth and State versus Wyden indicated that certified copies are required under 973.12? How do you get around that?
Well, I don't think I get around it at all. I think that goes to the question of whether or not this court ought to announce a rule that says, prospective in its application only, that the state should prove where it wishes to prove repeater status by relying upon a prior conviction, that that prior conviction should be certified. I indicated before, I think, in response to Justice Abrahamson's question, that it is certainly within the power and the authority of this court, I believe, to so hold. It may be that the court wishes would want to consider whether or not that's a subject that ought to be considered by what may still exist of the Judicial Council committee that examined and looked for a long period of time at the redrafting of substantial portions of the criminal procedure code. But that's an instrumental question. Does this court have the authority to issue such a rule as it did in Weidman and Spite, to issue a rule about what would be adequate proof? Of course it does. The state doesn't have an objection to such a rule. As we've made clear in our brief, tell us what the rule is and we'll comply with it. That does nothing for whether or not it ought to be applied backward-looking. I think it must be perspective only. It would be, I think, foolish to do otherwise. But I was addressing the specific question of does this defendant, does Mr. Saunders get the benefit of this brand new rule? And it's our view that if the court wishes to impose such a new rule, it should set aside the decision of the Court of Appeals and remand this case to the trial court for a hearing at which the new rule of law on what constitutes proof, required proof, where you rely upon a prior conviction, could be applied. We're ready and able to do that. Had such a rule been clearly in existence before, one can only hope that it would have been complied with here. And there's no reason to think that it couldn't be now. Now, I think I've addressed both the individual situation of this defendant and I think tangentially our question on the policy implication of what the law is should be for the future. It is within the power of this court to simplify, rationalize, and make more routine and easier to administer the law with respect to the proof of what prior conviction. If this court believes it is appropriate to issue such a rule, it is a law that can be easily complied with. But as I have said, this court declares the law, it becomes the obligation of the parties to comply with it. Tell us what the law is, and we'll do so. Don't ask us to anticipate it.
Do you think the certified copy is needed? As I understand Apprendi, this is one of the exceptions about not having to go to the jury.
All right, we've talked around Apprendi here. We don't have a jury question here.
I understand that. But it would seem to me one reason you don't need a jury question is that it's so readily available by proof without beyond question. So I'm wondering whether or not implicit, and I did not reread Apprendi last night, implicit in Apprendi is this concept that it has to be proof beyond question. But
I think the established case law in State versus Theriault holds that the proof needs to be beyond a reasonable doubt. I think Ms. Gannon has indicated that. And I think the same standard of proof, that terminology has been applied to both the prior, to both repeater status and to other.
And you, I assume, will agree that 91005 has applicability here, since that is a public record document of evidence.
If this court is now going to hold, which would also be new, that the rules of evidence, that these rules of evidence do apply for the purposes of establishing repeater status, then yes.
Why would that be new?
Excuse me?
Why would that be new?
I don't know of any court that's ever before held it. Moreover, just as I think there is some...
If this is part of the state's burden of proof, why would that be such a novel proposition?
Okay. For the same reason, for this reason, Justice Sykes, I don't think there's been any clear understanding in the law precisely what... let me put it this way. The court has on a number of occasions said that proof of a prior conviction is not an element of the offense. We think of proof of elements of offense as those things that must be proven at trial. The court has clearly said that, and Apprendi recognizes, that proof of a prior conviction is not an element, it is not something which a jury must find beyond a reasonable doubt by proof presented to trial. It is somehow different. It deals only with sentencing. Now, despite the fact that we've got case law saying that you're supposed to establish the prior conviction prior to sentence being imposed, which is what I think that means, I think everyone has long viewed the establishment of the prior conviction as a prerequisite to enhanced sentencing. So it's been viewed as kind of the sentencing process. I think it is a new development, and the sentencing process has been one in which we have all said, for so long, the rules of evidence don't technically apply. Thus, to say now that this is somehow not part of sentencing and the rules of evidence should apply to it, I think is, in fact, a new concept.
So you're going off 9-10.
Excuse me?
So you're going off with chapter 9-10. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Well, if this court holds that you need to prove these things, by a certified judgment of conviction, then I think that will bring with it, I assume that this court would also hold that the rules of evidence would be applicable under these circumstances. And by the way, indirectly, I think that will mean that in the absence of objection from defense counsel in the future, waiver arguments will be made.
Your argument is not that this is a mere sentencing factor.
No, it's not a mere sentencing factor. It's always been a hybrid. It's not a question of character and personality and among the McCleary major sentencing. It's always been something different, but it has never been viewed as an element of the crime that must be established at trial to the satisfaction of a jury beyond a reasonable doubt. It's been something in between those two things that's been more akin and relating to sentencing than it has been to guilt of the underlying charge.
Is it not really an element of the enhanced offense, but one that does not need to go to the jury as a part of the proof that the jury decides?
It's an element that must be proven in order to impose sentence.
Right, because it's part of the charged offense.
It is in that sense, yes. Right. And it must be proven to impose sentence, not to impose conviction.
And it must be proven beyond a reasonable doubt, but the judge can make that determination rather than the jury.
Right, exactly. That has been, and that is the established law. Yes.
But, and if it's going to be admitted, it can be admitted only by the defendant personally.
Well, we're not challenging that. That's the established law as well. Absolutely.
Just checking.
No question. We stand for fairness and justice as well.
All right. And
the American way.
Counsel, Mr. Gansner, thank you very much. And Ms. Hannon, thank you very much, both of you. We're